Lundgren.
Hello.
Sandra, you asked me something about witches, and
Yes.
I said I could tell a bit of, speak a bit about witches. And of course, there's a lot of difficulties in speaking about witches because the Western world culture has an enormous trauma on the memory of witches because of the witch hunts. And the witch hunts were essentially the Inquisition. And the Inquisition was basically a group of monks doing the job of the highway robber, licensed by the King of Spain and actually condoned by the Pope. So let me first go a bit into what the Inquisition was doing and what the effect of that was. Because once we understand the trauma that is associated with witches, we can just see that that has nothing to do with witches or Wicca or Vida or Vida, which is all about understanding life, working with life. Because most of the witches which were burned were actually the wise women of Europe. And essentially they were burned because as the wise women, they were the healers of the community. They also did the childbirth regulation, and as a result, the priests from Rome thought that they were in direct competition. And so the witch hunt was part of an attempt of male domination by priests in Rome. So the male domination was in part seen by the Pope colluding with Ferdinand of Spain. Ferdinand and Isabel were at that time sort of determining what people thought and did in Spain, and in that culture, at some point they realized that they didn't quite know what to do with the Moorish culture, which existed in the south of Spain, Andalus, and the Moorish culture had a lot of knowledge which the Spaniards at that time did not have. So had some Visigoths come over there from Europe, and so they had a bit of second-hand knowledge of what was happening in Europe. The area of Spain, of course, had been a colony of the Romans and the Greeks before them. But what was happening in the southern part of Spain was different because that came from the Moors and also the Phoenicians, and in a way the underlying current of what we would now call the Islamitic or Islam tribes. The southern culture was very they were doing very well. So the people in Andalus, they fared extremely well. They had high quality architecture. They understood how to control the water. They had gardens in places where you would have difficulty producing them, of course, as a result of knowing how to regulate the water. They had elevated medical care, and they also had a lot of art and culture combined with an extensive trade. And in that area, the Moors, the Jews, and the Christians and others were all working together, living together, and essentially doing very well. And in the rest of Europe, these people from that area, the Moorish tribe, were so well respected that a lot of the courts in Europe would want to have a Moor or two in their court. Because as physicians and as philosophers and as scientists and as artists, they were just a step ahead of everybody else, so to say. And there was also a very different mentality in the relationship, not only between the religions, but also between men and women. And some of that is seen because at the edge of that Moorish group, or people might say the empire, around the area of the Pyrenees between Spain and France, there were some of the castles where later on these Moorish customs and cultures of science and art and architecture and food and everything were still being done very well. But part of that was also the relationship between the male and the female. So the Moorish concept of relation between men and women was much more balanced, and later that was described in a more eloquent way, and that became actually the foundation of the troubadours, who later traveled over Europe when the Moors had been eliminated. And so the Moors were essentially eliminated because they were doing very well. The Catholics were essentially envious, and there are a couple of books on the history of the Inquisition, which basically said that Ferdinand and Isabel wanted to get rid of the Jews, they wanted to get rid of the Moors, and so they told them to go, but actually they also started to plunder them. So the Inquisition had then the motto of, okay, everybody who's not Christian needs to go. So they, in Spain, called that the re-Christianization of Spain, so everybody else had to go. Some did, some did not. Some were decided to turn into Christians, and so Muslims or Jews or others would become Christians. But that didn't quite do it for those Catholics. So at some point they decided, well, those Christians were not Christians enough. By the way, they were very rich, so they would just accuse them of not being so very good Christians, and that they needed to be punished, and as a result all of their money would be taken and all of that of their descendants. Quite nasty stuff. And the problematic bit of it is, was basically just one guy's idea, say a dozen guys acting on it, and then using money to pay or bribe or buy or hire some hoodlums of the area, who basically then got bonus money for declaring who was rich and why it was a good reason to rob them of their money. So then in all kind of regions of the Spanish Empire, and that's also South America, they then went on this hunt to basically rob the rich by the pretext that they weren't good Christians, what form or another. And so that led to a practice in which the Jews and the Moors and others basically realized that they were being targeted, but they also realized that there is this relationship between the king and the Pope, the one is sort of responsible for the earthly things and money, taxes, Caesar's, all that kind of stuff, and the Pope is supposed to be about the soul, the spirit, and the connection to God and freedom and being. So things emerged that first they would complain with the King of Spain, who would say, well, actually the Inquisition knows what they are doing and they come from the Pope, so it's actually none of my business, even though he would get a fairly large amount of whatever the Inquisition was raking in from robbing the rich. And so where the king had said that's actually a church thing, while basically there were his hoodwinks to do the robbing, the Pope realized that he then was made responsible for all of this, because of course the Inquisition was the Dominicans, or the Dominicans as they are called, and as a result they fell under the Pope because they were an order of monks, and as such they fell in the bookkeeping of the Roman Church. And so then the Pope would accept letters of complaint and would generally reply something, well, you didn't send the letter, the money for the return post. So he basically wanted to have money to show that this was serious business, and then he would basically declare that these people would be okay and take all the money of it, which was a considerable amount. A letter might go to the King of Spain, who then said, received your letter, but sorry, can't act on it, it's too late. So in that way, the Inquisition paid both the Pope and the King. The Inquisition got very rich of it, and a lot of people were very poor as a result of it. All of this was dramatized in court settings. Think of the church saying that they are spiritual, and the state declaring that they are about the practical, and then combine the idea of a court for both the one and the other, where basically the conduct of the people, what they believed and how they behaved, was being used as an excuse or a reason for saying that the people were in default and that they should pay for that. So that's where you then had this whole notion that the Catholics were basically trying to tell people how to behave. Nowadays we call it a totalitarian dictatorship. And they also tried to make sure that people were punished, which you would now call a system of elaborate and specific taxation. The history of the Inquisition led into two streams. One was the financial and the other was the moral. The system of taxation is now going on everywhere, and basically everybody pays for it, and the fines of the police are part of that. So the Catholic system of crime and punishment essentially was taken over by the state and is now less an activity of the church. The moral argument of why people were behaving or misbehaving is of course a very tricky thing, because basically it is one person saying, what you're doing I don't like. And then if it's one person against the other, it doesn't much matter, because both of them could be right. But as soon as there's a third, and the third actually starts to agree with one or the other, suddenly it's two against one. And a lot of the morality judgments by churches are based on turning a group against individuals. And those techniques and technologies have been developed in many political systems. And so dictatorships often use low-level economy people, the poor people, hire them to suppress the others. And this has also been done in not only by the Inquisition, the Dominicans, but later it was also part of what the Jesuits were doing. They basically became the spy system of the church, and out of that came systems like the Gestapo, the Stasis, the secret police in many countries. So in Stasi land, East Germany, there was a time where everybody was spying on everybody, and this was also something that was already done by the Inquisition. So one person would say, okay, we now have this story of what's wrong and what's right, so anybody who's doing things wrong, please let us know and you get some money for that. So people started to declare that other people were misbehaving. And of course you had all kind of false accusations coming in. The guy who didn't want to pay the money, for example, if you look later, Spinoza was at some point declared to be banned from his Jewish community because somebody had borrowed money from him and didn't want to pay it back. So the group system of correction was used, abused to punish Spinoza for something. And in this way you can see that in the Inquisition, with the Gestapo, with the Stasis, people would start to tell on other people of what they did, how they misbehaved, while in quite a number of cases they were just out on a personal vendetta. They didn't like somebody, they didn't know how to retaliate, so made use of this general system of, okay, let's punish the other. And it is intriguing because if you look into the books on the Inquisition, you can see that these were dramatical, theatrical procedures or proceedings of a court of law, but they were court of law mainly in that sense that there was a scribe, and there was a principal of accuse and defense, and there was a judge. And of course the system of law is very much based on how the relationship between the judge and the accused, they're sort of opposite. The accused is basically neutral as long as there is no proof of guilt or innocence. The judge on the other side is supposed to draw a conclusion of guilt or innocence over the other, so it's the father-child relationship. And then there's the accuser and the defender, which basically say, well, this is a guilty party or this is not a guilty party. And out of the conversation between those two, and the judge would then declare if the accused would be guilty or innocent, and what would happen. So basically there's four people in a game, and in many cases the accused does not get to speak. Basically it's the neighbor who is represented by the accuser, and it is the accused who is represented by the defender. So you don't hear the accused. Instead you hear the defense and the attack, the two lawyers, both of which of course are part of the law system, and that could be a state system or a church system. But as part of the law system, they are really not representing the individual. They're presenting a philosophy or a code of conduct, and as we can see throughout the ages, that's very arbitrary. And then the judge is supposedly impartial and needs to evaluate what the accuser and defender say on behalf of that person. So at some point in the Inquisition they thought, well, as the accused does not speak anyhow, why bother having that one around? And as the accuser and defender both come out of the legal society, legal group, they thought, well, why have it done by two people? Why not just have one person doing the one and the other? And then, of course, they thought, well, if we have this, that we have one person deciding for the good and the bad anyhow, and the judge is supposed to do that also, why not just bring it back to one person? So that's essentially the difference between political systems. In a dictatorship, the judge is also the accuser, the defender, and the condemner. In an oligarchy, you might have an accuser and a defender sort of working it out between them. In a democracy, you would certainly need a judge and an accuser and a defender. And in a fully legal system, the accused, in an autarchy, the accused would speak their own law. And then from there, they would need to decide how to accommodate for the laws of other people. So this principle of law is at the essence of how you relate between the individual and the group. So if you have four people, then do you have one individual represented by a neutral judge, or and you have the accuser and defender sort of opposing each other, having a field of balance of or disbalance played out between them? about which the judge, as a kind of innocent bystander, then judges as an outsider on behalf of the person who is being accused. So is what they did acceptable or not acceptable by what anybody else would do? But the what anybody else would do suddenly brings us in the realm of the law of the land. And there you can say that if you go from one land to the other, or from one period of time to the other, or from one moment to the other, from one person to the other, the laws will be arbitrarily different. And the laws which have been valid in one time are not necessarily valid in the other. And also you can see that there are laws made for people and by people, of which it is no longer said that they are made for people by people. So suddenly they are laws of God, but who is God? And how is it possible that God, who is then an immaterial being, can use a pen and write things? So suddenly you have this opposition, not just of the individual and the group, but also of the human and the abstraction. And all of this is part of the interplay that comes along in this witch hunt story, because it's only when you disentangle all these layers of relationship between individual and group that you can see what kind of abuse of power was taking place in the witch hunt. It's not just the Pope and the King sort of doing spirit and body, but also the Inquisition and the population, as sort of the moral code versus the conduct of behavior. And evidently this was also in a time where people were still trying to understand how individuals in groups could come to a larger understanding. Because after the Greek wars, the Roman wars, basically one tribe would do things differently than another tribe. Different tribes would not understand each other. They would soon misunderstand each other. They might even fly at each other's throat. They would start to rob and pillage each other. Greed and all the other stuff came in. So suddenly you are not just dealing with the relation between the individual and the other individual, or the relation between the individual and the group, but you're also relating to the individual and the land, and specifically the land in summer and the land in winter, or the fertile land or the barren land, or specifically the individual with food and the individual without food. So that is essentially the problem of the financial system of the Western world and elsewhere. The individual which has food, is that the food of the individual, or is it the food of the earth? Well, evidently the food comes from the earth, so it's the food of the earth. So if another individual had been there, the other individual would have been eating the earth. So if an individual lives somewhere, then that's different from an individual who's nomadic. So suddenly in the whole story you have this relationship between the settled individuals and the nomadic individuals. Of course, the individuals, the people, used to be nomadic, because as the seasons change, they would move along with where the berries would be ripening, or if they move north, then where the one berries had been ripened already, the berries a bit further north would be ripened the week after, and a bit further north they would ripen the week after. And so you could follow the trail of the ripening berries in the same way that birds would move from north to south depending on where the temperature was, the temperature that they like. So nomadic people would just travel the earth and find food. But at the moment that people started to settle, they would basically stay in a place where they had found food and try to go out and get some more food from somewhere else for the rest of the year. And then when the summer came again, they would be sitting right in the middle of the food already. So they, in a way, were like people in a shop where they say the sale starts at 8 o'clock in the morning and early the evening before, people already queue up so that they can have a first place to get there. So in a way, this is also the story of the relationship between the nomadic tribes and the settlers. And in a way, many of the laws of the land have become the laws of the settlers and are no longer the laws of the nomads. So they are no longer the laws of the humans, but more specifically the laws of the specific tribe. And then how do you relate the interests of the one tribe versus the other? In the case of the nomadic tribe versus the settler tribe, it is quite clear. But how does that work with the tribe on the one side of the river and the other side of the river, or the tribe in the valley versus the tribe on the mountains? Because being in the valley is like being in the summer, being up the mountains is like being more in the winter. So a different position is like a different migration in time. So there was a confusion about how to deal with something where the food actually is all food of earth. And you then discover that people in a way try to claim that they might have the first go at the food because they found it first when the nomads were traveling in different directions, or they were there first because the settlers had already built a hut there and the nomads came by later. So there was a difficulty in sorting all that out, and as a result the moral code of conduct was difficult as well, because people started to confuse being in the place with owning the food, and they forgot that the food is of earth and that essentially every animal and every human would be entitled to the same. They started to claim that I was here first, or I was closer, I saw it first, kind of thing, and claiming priority over the other at the expense of the other. And that's where you see the difference between laws of monopoly, one individual can use it, or laws of sharing. That is what we now know as the difference between capitalism and communism. And capitalism, basically, you can claim ownership and exclusivity. And in communism, basically what Earth has is there for everybody. And you can see that over 2,000 years already, probably longer, people are confused on how this works. So, at the time of the Inquisition, there was the Pope and the King on the spirit versus the body. There was the Inquisition versus the population. Again, sort of mind versus body, or consciousness versus conduct. In a time where people were still trying to sort out how to work together, and out of that came a difference which has to do with the development of individuality, that people grow up from baby to child to adolescent to adult, and when they're in baby phase they're totally dependent. As child they are sort of self-standing, they can do bits within a small domain. As adolescents, they learn to walk around, just like animals going from one territory to another. And as adults, basically, they're able to negotiate different territories and can combine them. But some people, when they grow up, they don't grow up all the way. Some get stuck in the baby mode of being dependent. So they want others to keep on caring and providing for them. And in many tribes you find that all four capacities are there. Some people are in a caring, being cared for mode, and that would generally be the babies and the old age people who can't move around too much anymore, people who are sick, people who are visitors, who don't have a specific role, so they would be cared for. And then there are the people who can help out a bit, like children, and those are the artisans and the craft people, the helpers, the ones who arrange things. So they contribute, but they still need to be fed, clothed, and housed. I said they do other things than providing the clothing, the housing, And then there's another group which is actually busy with the harvesting, the gathering, the fetching water, the chopping wood, making sure that everything that people need to survive is there. There is also a group which sort of transcends that level of caring and providing and doing, and they are the people who by experience know how you can do something better and easier. And that's a bit what at the time of the witch hunt was this normal approach in society, that this development from baby to child to adolescent to adult was actually called the transition from a lay person to an apprentice, and then a journeyman, and then a master in the guild system. So in that sense, you would grow into society by growing into a specific aspect of society where you would either be cared for, or you would support things, or you would do things, or you would help coordinate things. Four levels of the, say, the castes of India. While that system was still being developed, there was no good understanding on how you can control that. So there was not a wise system for coordinating the conduct. So from the king's side, they tried to do it in the behavior and punishment of people. From the pope's side, they tried to do it in what people believe and their misbeliefs. And somehow that didn't work well. That's also why we don't use it in that form anymore. And the Inquisition was a bit the transition zone between the conflict of church and state. Where does the empowerment lie? Is it conduct something that comes from spirit? Or is conduct only to do with how much you provide and how much you can be taxed for that? So in that time of confusion, they decided, okay, let's make it simple. Let's grab the richest and take all their money. And all those kind of approaches have now been institutionalized to a taxation system. As I mentioned earlier, there is a need for a discrimination system, a code of conduct, a code of condemnation, a code of reward. And so in the Inquisition, you saw that they had to think up reasons why somebody would or would not be contributing to society. Again, capitalism versus communism. Are you the owner or are you the consumer? All these things which humanity still has not resolved very well. So at that time, they sort of galloped overboard with it, because they, on the one hand, were basically simply cashing in on the wealth of the richest, and on the other hand, were claiming that they could do so because God had told them, I said so. So they were confusing church and state, which is also what had to be resolved later. And they gave so-called moral arguments on why people did or did not behave well. So now I come back to what I said earlier, that the discrimination of people behaving or well or not well, it's essentially only in the judgment of others. Evidently, if people misbehave, they will walk into the tree of walking past it because they didn't judge it well. They might walk into somebody instead of past somebody if they didn't judge it well. In case of drunkenness, that could happen often. But sometimes people run into another instead of past them, as is the case in rape, by not respecting the boundaries and the integrity of the other. And sometimes people actually rob from people or murder people, which is a further disrespect of life. So in the whole quest of morality, where do you stand? How do you discern these different levels of involvement? And can you in some way find a solution for it? Well, actually they didn't. So the moral judgment which they had from the church belief system, which was the Bible, and the social code of conduct which they had in the state system, which is essentially the system for taxation, didn't work too well either. So, as I said, they galloped overboard. They just made up a number of excuses why somebody would behave or not behave, and that led to the Maleficatorum, which is the hammer of the evildoers. And sometimes you hear politicians still talk about the evildoers, and then you know that they're still relatives of the Inquisition somewhere in their mind. So there was this whole notion of evildoers, but what's an evildoer? Because if you look at good and evil, then actually God and devil are the associated word. Good and God, evil and devil, devil are associated words. So basically it's a word game of that what is appropriate and that what is not appropriate. And when you look in our body, you can actually see that a disease is a dis-ease, which most often is something happening in the body which should normally happen something somewhere else. So in the same way, good and evil in society, somebody is doing something which basically he should be doing somewhere else. So as somebody walks into the house of people and takes the food that lies there instead of going to the field and taking the food that lies there. So if you teach that individual that instead of going into the house of people and take the food that lies there, they can also go to the field and take the food that lies there, then the evil has immediately turned into good. And in case they are sick, they might not be able to go to the field, and then they can talk with their neighbors, say, well, today I can't go to the field, can you bring me some fruits too? And by the way, if this would ever happen to you that you can't go there, then of course I can bring some fruit for you when I come back. In a society of abundance, you would simply have a combination of those two things, that one could go and the other can stay at home, that some people go to the field and bring back for the people who stay at home. So basically they're swapping in a different way. But if you don't have that understanding of sharing and go to the other side of ownership and monopoly, then suddenly you would own things, and instead of sharing what the earth gives, you would have to get somebody what somebody else had gotten. So when somebody goes to the fields and gets something and brings it back, then because they got it from the field, you would have to do something for them to be able to earn getting some of the food which they got free from the earth. So the whole financial system came out of that, and a tally system of, reward and punishment, or excess and deficit, or generosity and debt, as different kind of economical philosophy. But that philosophy, economics of reward and punishment, getting money or not getting money, is also what they then try to do for the moral code of conduct, what you should do, should not do. And the Malus Maleficatorum, the hammer of the evildoers, was a book written describing what defines a witch. And here we get to the necessity to split the story, because on the one hand we need to round off the story of what the people of the Inquisition, the robber man, said that the witch was, and we need to understand what a witch is, which comes from the word Wicca, or the word Vida, or the word Vida, and those are words associated with knowledge and life. So to first conclude that part of the Inquisition, few people, basically one, and then getting some pals to agree with that, wrote a book of this is the evil doer, this is the good doer. Well, we already know what the good doer should be because that's what's written in the Bible. So the evil doer is somebody who does this and that and the other. And in that sense, the witch hunt was never about a conduct, but was against a specific code of success of other people. And then you can see that the manual for the witch hunt was specifically written to persecute one group of people and not persecute another group of people. That was what the Inquisition was doing. That's what all the anti-discrimination laws try to prevent, that one group of people tries to destroy another group of people for their own direct or indirect benefit. And when you look at the principle of the Inquisition on a whole, as you would say in the detective story, who benefits, follow the flow of the money, and then you can see that much of the Inquisition and the witch hunt was directed against people who in one way or the other could oppose the Catholic Church. So it was the Jews, it was the wealthy, it was the people who were self-sufficient, it was the people who had no need for the Catholics, for example the Cathars, which were actually were doing what the Bible was preaching. And so the Vatican Church was very much the extension or continuity of the Roman army, and the Roman army basically conquered everybody that they were envious of, and anybody that who got in their way of who was able to defend themselves, they would just destroy totally. Very narcissistic behavior, by the way. So in that sense, the Inquisition was part of the narcissistic self-expression of the Catholic Church, at the detriment of anything that could oppose or limit or give an alternative to what the Church said that they were doing. So one of the groups of people who was sort of eradicated were, as I said, the wise women of Europe, because the Vatican used the priests, and actually they had introduced celibacy way time earlier, because at that time whatever was left behind when people died was given to their family. People who did not have family, the leftovers of the dead would go to the society that they formed part of. So the Catholic Church had realized that if people did not marry, then the dead Jews did not go to the family but fell to the Church. So one generation later, they would acquire everything of anybody who was in their church system. So they had all these unmarried people, and in a way they were still also very Roman in being patriarchal, a male-oriented, male-dominated. So they had a bit of a difficulty with the female wisdom of the society, because the wise women of the society, they knew how to find the herbs to heal people, they knew how to find herbs to psychologically get people back on track. St. John's Wort and others, if people were depressed. So in a sense they were actually doing what the Church said that people could get from listening to a story in a church. So where the stories should make people feel better, because there was this nice example that people could live by, or there were these examples of how people should behave and resolve conflict either by letting it go or really hammering on it. In that same way, there was this alternative to it by women who were helping people to feel better in body, mind, soul, spirit. They also did a birth regulation, and they also had a powerful influence on the connectedness in the community. So it's not surprising that the guys of the church try to get rid of the women in the healing professions, the midwives and healer women. So they basically went for them. And so then the story came up that these were women who were doing satanic practices, would get together naked and have sex and do all kinds of things which the Bible says you cannot do. What's quite funny, because if you look at the descriptions of some of the research into the Vatican, then the Vatican was built on the Mons Vaticanus, which was a burial mound where you had grottos and you had snakes, and that whole place was associated with Lucifer and the devil. And as the whole mental technology of the Catholic Church was exported from Babylon, you could also say that that again was the devil worship having its seat in the Vatican. So when the people from the Vatican said that the witches were venerating the devil, then there's an interesting paradox in there. And when you look back further in the history of Christianity, you can see that that came out of Egypt, where you had the Delta tribe and the Desert tribe. The Delta tribe, there was abundance and the god of good, and the Desert tribe, there was scarcity and the god of punishment. And basically they called that later God and evil, or God and devil. But actually, God and devil are both the principles of nature, one with the face of abundance, one with the face of shortage. And so you can also see that in many different tribes, they have their God, and they say that the God of the other guys is the devil. So in that sense, basically you can say that God is the belief that people have, and devil is the belief of the other people. And so that story was then used in the witch hunt, that these were devil worshippers. And again, had the sex, the drugs, and the rock and roll, which were then banned by the church. And that was also the time that the church didn't have much music, no organs in the church, polyphonic singing still was being invented. Everything was very sober, no musical instruments in the church. And austerity was the baseline of what they were doing. So in that environment, the conflict between God and devil is very arbitrary indeed. And if you look at the fight itself, essentially it is just the eradication of the potential opposition of the church in Rome. So let me leave the description of the persecution of the witches by the Inquisition at that. There are some very good books on what happened in the Inquisition. There's some very good books who explain how God and devil are actually interchangeable topics. And together you can see that the witch hunt was actually just a political discrimination, apartheid thing for political, financial, economic gain of a few over the many as so often. Now let's come to the other part of the story, that these people were called witches, and that refers to Wicca. Sometimes it's also related to Hecate. Most often it is to the goddess of the moon. And actually, when you look back in history, you can see that the religions all refer to the stars, the sun, the moon, the earth. And so those are the four components of our life on earth. And it basically depends on where you choose your orientation, how you will interact with the earth and with each other. So for the Muslims, they choose the moon as being crucial, and Allah is actually one of the old words for moon. And Wicca, Hecate are also related to the moon and the moon cycle. Moon cycle is also the menstruational cycle, thus the power of women, matriarchy. So in that sense, paradoxically, you do not see that in the Muslim belief, but you see that in the moon cultures. Moon cultures are where the women are seen as being the pivot of life, the keepers of the home and the garden, and the continuity of the species. So where Islam has the moon as its central theme, Christianity has the sun as the central theme. And note there is the word game of the sun with the O and the sun with the U. So when they talk about the Son of God or the Son of the Light, they are actually talking about the same. And if you look further, you can see that the sun is also the light. So that in that sense, the sun is also the light bringer or the light giver. And suddenly you're talking about Lucifer again. But the sun is also related to the male. The sun radiates and the moon reflects. The man has 15% more muscle and is thus more active, and the woman has 15% more fat tissue and can survive longer. So there is a kind of complementarity between male and female, as between sun and moon, and that is often be represented as the difference between gold and silver, active, passive, yang and yin. And it's a complementarity, which of course is meaningful only if you see that there are two poles of the same. So the male and the female together can produce a human. And the moon and the earth together determine the tides on the earth. So having looked at the moon and Islam and the sun and Christianity, the star is what you see in the Hebraic religion. So the Star of David is actually the star. So their notion is to look at the earth, but further than the moon, further than the sun, to the setting of the universe as a whole. And all of these different perspectives, earth, moon, sun, star, are what you see in the relationship between Islam, Christianity, the Hebraic religion, and the original Pharaonic or Dogon religion. So you can see that there is a shift of scope of vision in how you look at what humans do on earth. Evidently, all of the religions are about humans living on earth. But do you look at the way the moon and the tidal seasons of the month and the menstruational cycles are involved? Are you looking at the menstruational cycle of the human, which of course determines birth and death in humans? Or are you looking at the sun with the cycle of the seasons, and suddenly you're not looking at the humans alone, but you're looking at the seasons and all of life, summer and winter, food and starvation, for all of the animals and all of the plants? Are the leaves on the plants or not? So with the sun cycle, you can look at that, life on earth in general. When you look at the stars, you can see that actually the sun and the moon and the earth are part of a much larger principle. So that there is something going on which is beyond the survival of humanity with birth and death. There is more than the living of humanity with food and starvation. But there is actually an experience of life as creator in creation, in the most cosmic sense. And the original religions are now called theocracies, theos of God, and kratos, the strength. So those were political systems based on beliefs. And is it based on the universe and the stars? Is it based on the sun and the seasons? Is it based on the moon and menstruation? Or is it based on earth and the house and the body that you live in? So, depending on where you stand, you will have a different connectedness to it. And when you look at the religion, you can see that from the Dogon religion, which came from the stars, as they say, you have one branch which went to Egypt, where theoretical and highly scientific technology of consciousness was explored, and the pyramids were part of the electric machineries for communication, telecommunication, control of the weather, and even warfare. On the other side, you have the Assyrian, Babylonian side of the story, which was much more into genetic sexual understanding of working with the earth and caring for the culture. So on the one hand, you had, say, the more theoretical, say, electric or star-based approaches of the Egyptians, and on the other hand, you had more practical or sex and genetic earth-based practices of the Babylonians. And the Hebrew tribe sort of hovered between the one and the other, and they sort of denied the one, denied the other, and came up with something else for themselves. But all of those different ways of relating to the universe and your life in that universe can be thus regarded from different perspectives. And then in that sense, you could say that the Egyptians were the sorcerers and the Babylonians were the witches. The Egyptians were working with the magic of consciousness and understanding and energies. And the Babylonians were working with the understanding of the lunar cycles, the seasonal cycles, and how we as humans form part of it. So in a way, it was technology versus agriculture. In a way, it was male versus female. In a male, it was the cosmos versus the earth. And as you try to understand how this works, then of course you need to grow into that understanding. So as a baby, you just experience that everything happens around you, and you still have to work out what your place is in it. As a child, you start to see that there are patterns in it, and that somehow you can play and interact with it, but you're not quite sure how you can do it. That's the level of storytelling, singing songs, manipulation of symbols, and let's say superstitious beliefs. Then comes the next level of development. It's called the level of puberty, where you get the hang of it, of how to actually work with it. You understand that sex actually leads to birth. You understand that plants come from seeds. You can collect seeds from the fruits. You can plant the seeds from the fruits. You can actually choose the place where you want to do that. So it's not just symbolic singing a song about something, but having songs and stories to remember things that worked in one season and that you can use in another season. And that it's not just a picture of a plant, but having a store of seeds of the plant that you can actually put in the ground in the right moment, and that you have a memory script or a memory glyph or a reminder somehow that you know which day would be the best to put the seed in the soil. And of course in Egypt, where you would then have the floods coming by. You would have to wait after the floods have gone to plant. So there you actually go into the third level of development, is where you are not in the level of superstition, but you're in the level of, say, practical magic. You're actually doing the things. You're applying a practice which works. Once you've done that a couple of times, you can reach to the fourth level of understanding, is that over the seasons you know that you better plant after the floods, but you look for markers by which you can sort of understand when the floods will come. And that's where you then go into the understanding of the stars, which stars do you need to see above the horizon to know that a couple of hundred kilometers further the rains would be coming, and that the Nile would be flooding, and that the flood would fill the Nile Valley, and you can count on that then. So that fourth level is the level of actual understanding. So you go from pragmatic understanding to theoretical understanding. So you have gone from the level of ignorance to the level of superstition, symbols which by themselves have no meaning, to then the practical understanding, where you actually know how these symbols connect to things that you can do. You actually know that you can flick the light switch. And then the fourth level, that you can actually design light switches because you know how you can pump the electricity around. So those level of knowledge, understanding, are associated with different kinds of magic. Magic is actually from a Sanskrit word magd, which means power. So in that sense, it is about growing into the power of essentially your participation in creation. And there's definitely two parts of that. Say there's the body part, what you do with your own body and other people. Say that's the Babylonian side of the story, which would be the witchcraft of the understanding of your own body, sexual relations with others, having pregnancy, caring for children, but also the cultivation of cultures and communities. Or you have this side of the sorcerer of the Egyptians, who do the calculations of the stars and have an understanding of theoretical constructs of how cosmic influences operate around us, and allegedly had all kinds of electronic devices based on stone antennas and other knowledge which they had. So they would be the side of the sorcerers. And when you look at present day magic, and that magic then applies to both witches and sorcerers, and witches would be most identified with the female and sorcerers with the male, but you also have male witches and you also have female sorcerers. Actually, the word sorcerers comes from the French word source, source, a sourcier, and those were the keepers of the well. So they were pivotal in the community. And at Glastonbury, you still have that the respected couple in the village can live in the house next to the well, because they need to protect the well. They need to make sure that things do not fall into the well. They make sure that people don't throw junk into the well. And as a result, they become the meeting point for the people at the well. They get to know all the stories of the people around in that community, so they can tell other people about the stories that they've heard. They have the water by which people can irrigate their gardens. So the people at the source, or the sorcerers, or the sorcier, the providers, are then the pivot of the community. Just like the wise women or the witches, the the women who used the knowledge of the plants and the seasons of the herbs and were the healers. So the word of the sorcerers then comes from the people who are attuned with the use of the water in the gardens of the village and know the stories of the people and care for the well, care for the people, care for the stories and so on. So in both cases, the witches and the sorcerers are the people who have that kind of knowledge which you would want to have beyond the level of just doing your own thing without a care in the world, and whose knowledge would become relevant at the moment that you're out of that baby mode of everything goes well and to the level of the child learning to stand up and fall and get up, fall and get up, is where you learn to care for your own ills and diseases by getting to know the herbs and the treatments that you can give yourself or can give others for getting rid of your dis-ease, so that you can come back to the ease. And those people, the witches and the sorcerers, would also have the knowledge of what to do next if you need more than irrigate the garden, but if you actually need to get the plants which are no longer in the garden, and you should have actually stored up on those plants because they are no longer in the garden, but by understanding the meaning of those plants you have stored them. So the third level of resourcefulness is then to have resources, to have stores of what grew in one season to carry that over in another season, so that you can actually use the power of one season, and that could be the supply of water, that could be the supply of the herbs, that could be the supply of the seeds, and then out of that you're able to go through the dead season where the sun is gone and where the moon is cold, and that you can come out through the winter season at the other end. And that's also why for the witches and the sorcerers, for all those people who needed to connect what people do to what they do in their house and their garden, to what people can do together in their community at the third level, to what people can do on the earth in the seasons. So with these understandings in place, then you can see that the sorcerers were actually the resource for people to be able to survive things which are otherwise seemingly desperate. And that's also the reason why for those peoples the rhythm of the winter was very important, so that in the 21st of December, actually it, for them at Dekem it was the 10th month, they counted till January is the 11th month and then February is the 12th month. So in March for them it started again, because then things started to grow again. So in what we now call the 21st of December, we have the turning of the winter, and that is what then is celebrated as the return of the sun, which is the star in the sky, and which has been sort of ritualized, put in a very rudimentary story form as the return of the sun in the Christian story. So then you can see how in different belief systems they used metaphors or symbols for this level of symbolic understanding, the superstitious understanding. So at that level, all religions always include a superstition, a set of symbols which is meaningless if you do not know what it refers to. And once you know what it refers to, you still need to know why it refers to that. So to know that December is the rebirth of the sun, which by the way comes from the religion of Mithras from Persia, which was then taken into the Roman system, the Roman soldiers brought that back, and they had the Mithras festivities in the cave, of course in the dark, because throughout the rest of the years you didn't have the winter, so you needed to somehow have the notion that you were still thinking about this continuity of the cycle at the moment that nothing seems to live anymore in the middle of winter. So to celebrate that in the cave was a logical choice. That could be the cellar of a building or a cave in the mountains or anything which could be dark enough to celebrate the rebirth of the light. That rebirth of the light was then introduced back in Christianity, and that is what then became Christmas. So you need to understand that when the Christians or the Catholics or the Inquisition was persecuting the witches, it is actually the belief in the return of the sun persecuting the people who are working with the belief on the sun. So then again you can see that the underlying belief system is the same, and that the reason for the witch hunt is totally different. So with the Inquisition and be put in view, we can understand why there is such a traumatic association to the word witch. When we look into the word witch, we see that it's the word wicca, and that the word sorceress come from the source and resourcefulness, and in both cases we see that it has to do with the understanding of the rhythm of the seasons, and more specifically the ability to individually and together as humanity on Earth be able to be so resourceful that we can have resources to survive the winter. And that essentially witchcraft and church, religion, politics, state are all serving that same interest, that we can't survive moments of very deep despair or lack of resourcefulness, of lack of resource, no source. And once you understand that, then you can understand that witchcraft and sorcery, which then refers to the capacities, capabilities to survive in nature, but also to heal from nature, to help each other, to build society, exactly what the witches were accused of doing, which at that time the Catholic Church tried to monopolize at the time of the witch hunts, is all referring to the same. The Catholic Church was trying to provide a social system by which people could be helped. The witches were providing a social support system by which people could be helped. The difference was that the Catholic Church did it in the form of the Roman army. The witches were doing at the level of the individuals with a network of interchanges connected from the individual level. So basically you have the difference between the group and the individual there yet again, just as I mentioned before, at that level of judgment. So what determines the validity of a judgment? Is the group right? No, group is just a group of individuals. And if the individuals are wrong, then the group will be wrong too. So we need to look at this at a deeper level, and then you can see that the right or wrong is actually how you are connected to your environment. And then, let's say the witchiness of people has much to do with how they themselves are aware of their own four levels of development, that their baby level of neediness and dependency, that they know that they are needy, they need to breathe, they need to drink water, they need to eat fruits, and they need to have experience on life. So once they realize that, then they can cover the needs which for a baby are implicit. Witches and sorcerers and other people, they just become aware what their needs are. And then as child, the child level of development is that they learn to cater to their needs. First of all, they need to know what the needs are, so that they can recognize them in their environment, and that they can know where they can find the air, the water, the food, and the shelter. But also that they need to know in themselves, from themselves, within their body, what the signals are for their needs. How far can they stay away from a house in the winter or in the summer? How far can they walk away from the harvest in one territory or the other, from one season to the other? To which extent can they go without supplies of food and water and air? And essentially, at which part will they lose themselves in their body, mind, soul, and spirit? So at that third level, the adolescent level, they sort of need to know their boundaries and need to know how to work with that. So they need a sensitivity. They need an ability to know within themselves what the signals are of impending thirst, impending hunger, because they need to be able to care for their body and their mind and their soul and their spirit before the mind starts to backfire because something is lacking. So they need to develop that sensitivity, which goes beyond the understanding. So first you need to know what you are and what your needs are. The second is that you need to know how you can fulfill your needs and where you can find that. The third is that you need to be able to know how you can prevent those needs by having the inner awareness that you already start to do things. You start to prepare a meal before you are dead of hunger. And the fourth level is that you actually have a sensitivity, or let's call it the super sensitivity, that you know that you need to feed not only yourself, but also the people around you. You might need to feed your child, so you need to take that into account. You might as well feed your partner, so you take that into account. You might as well feed the neighbors, because they might be needy. So you extend your generosity, but that also means that you change your event horizon of your awareness from being self-centered or mother and baby centered, the Mary and Jesus picture. So you have the individual, which would be the Jesus alone. You have the Mary and Jesus, which would be a mother caring for the child, having a next level of awareness. And then you have the Mary, Joseph and Jesus, which means that you not only have to caring for the child, but you also have to caring for the mother come in. And then at the fourth level, you get that you don't only care for your own family, but also the family of others. So you expand in your consciousness, you expand in your awareness, you expand in your understanding of how resources or resourcefulness you need to have, but also expand in the need of understanding where you can find backup resources. Can you get it from the next season? Can you get it over the hill in the next valley? You need to have your resource extended beyond the horizon where you are at that